Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning in to Ask Me Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. This week, a local author comes into her own, a congressional act has a big anniversary, and a filmmaker who is neither Native nor American talks about his film, screened this year on Indigenous Peoples Day. Stay tuned. Resident Renee Linnell's new memoir, The Burn Zone, describes what led her to and what eventually drove her from a Buddhist cult. In her book, Linnell details how her deep longing for acceptance led to her being brainwashed by the cult's leaders, who controlled everything from clothing to diet, with extensive verbal abuse. She says the traumatic experience gave her a new sense of strength. Linnell sat down with arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay.
I'd love for you to describe the book in your own words.
My description of the book would be a journey to wholeness through forgiveness and self-betrayal, to finding my true essence and no longer apologizing for it. But I do take the reader through my joining a cult and being brainwashed, through the background of my life, which led me to join a cult, and through my coming out the other side. So it really is like a roadmap for people to overcome serious betrayal, life-shattering events, loss of loved ones, and to come out the other side more joyful than they've ever been.
For people who haven't experienced, I hesitate to say like as extreme, but who haven't necessarily experienced exactly what you have, what are you offering people?
I believe what I'm offering people is a permission slip to finally and truly be yourselves. I think we're taught from such a young age that we're not okay the way we are, that we have to change to be approved of, to blend in, to not be abandoned. And I don't think that there's enough messaging out there that says that we're supposed to be unique and different. And that when we hide our differences and try to blend in, we do ourselves and the world a huge disservice.
I think writing the book seems, and you acknowledge this, that writing this book and like facing the story makes you extremely vulnerable, that you've put yourself in such a vulnerable place. And the event at Explore here in Aspen is the first event of this book tour that you're embarking on, which just seems to me like a whole new level of vulnerability and putting yourself out there. So I'm just wondering what your emotions are. Like, what, why are you doing this?
It's such a good question. And I do go through phases where I think, oh my gosh, I'm so excited. And then I think, I live in a really small town, and suddenly everyone is going to know everything about me. But the truth is, it's so incredibly liberating to just be me and to have it all in writing and to not apologize for it and to say, this is me, this is my stuff, you can like me or not like me, and I'm not really going to change anymore. I spent my whole life trying to change, and now I just want to live.
This book made me think a lot about intuition, that little voice in our head, or like that feeling that, look, like I think everybody has ignored at their peril at some point. I guess I'm wondering what you learned about intuition through your experiences.
What I learned about intuition is that we all have it. It's a gift that we're born with, and it is our inner guidance system. But we're trained from a very young age to not listen to it. And especially as children, when we start to enforce boundaries in order to listen to our intuition, we're told that we're bad, girls and boys, or we're displeasing the adults. And so we learn to not listen to our intuition. And what I discovered is as in any toxic relationship, you're also trained away from listening to your intuition. And what I discovered is as I started to really listen to it and act on it and follow it, I was rewarded. My life became better. I was able to trust it more, and it's like a muscle. It gets stronger and stronger and stronger the more you listen to it and follow it and act on it.
Let's talk about the process of writing this. Talk about reconstructing the experiences here.
It started as a catharsis. So when I moved from New York to Colorado, I had to get it out of me. And so I was just writing and writing and writing. And what I tell anyone who has a story inside that wants to come out, you just vomit it all onto the page. And you repeat yourself over and over and make it raw and unpunctuated and unedited. And so I just had to get it out. And then I started having the courage to tell people about what had happened. And when I did so, they all said the same thing. You have to write a book. And I realized I had about 700 pages of journal entries. I had been writing a book. And so then I asked an NYU colleague of mine who was the VP of marketing for Random House what I do. I said, I have all of this written and now I'm stuck. I don't know where to go next. And she said, you need an editor, which I didn't know. I was so new to the whole thing. So she put me in touch with an amazing editor who read 15 pages and took me on as a client. And she helped turn my vomit, as she called it, into a book.
What was that like for you?
It was difficult because this was my most personal thoughts and feelings and experiences being exposed to somebody who was critiquing them. And so I would submit a chapter and then she would submit notes. And every time I got the notes, I'd be furious. And I would think, she doesn't know me. She doesn't know what she's talking about. She's wrong. And I would close the computer and I would be in this state of fury. And I had a week to get them back to her. And within a week, I was able to say she's right about every single thing. She was absolutely right. And I got desensitized as I went along, which I realized I needed to do in order to bring my book out into the world, to finally get to the place where I say, this is my offering. This is my story. This is the best job I could do. And people don't have to love it.
What's next for you? Will you continue on this path of authorship?
I will definitely keep writing. I love writing. And I'll spend a lot of time promoting the book right now with the book tour and the interviews. And I love the message, the idea of spreading the message that we need to own our stories. It's time to own our stories. And I imagine us all kind of as children being able to run around free and unbound by shame, and just expressing our unique selves in the world as loudly as possible. So I don't know if that looks like workshops, speaking engagements, writing classes. I'm not sure. Something like that.
You are listening to Aspen Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. That was Renee Linnell speaking with arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay. Filming Neither Wolf Nor Dog, which follows a white author who tries to chronicle the experience of a Lakota elder. David Bald Eagle stars in the film, which debuted on Aspen's second Indigenous Peoples Day. Bald Eagle had a profound connection to the land where the film was shot. Simpson urged him to channel his past through his acting. The director discussed working with Bald Eagle and challenges in telling Native American stories with reporter Zoe Rome.
Well, it's essentially a road movie, taking place through the heart of the Dakotas. It follows the journey of a white author that gets sucked into this road trip by a Lakota elder and the Lakota elder's best friend, and the elder is trying to open his eyes to the reality of his worldview and contemporary life.
And what drew you to this story? Obviously, it's kind of about a white man coming in to tell a Native American story. Do you see any parallels there, and why did you feel compelled to take this on?
Well, ordinarily, I'd actually gone in the opposite direction from it. I try not to do things that are sort of, you know, a bit on the nose. But this one, the author approached me with it, and there was something I could relate to. You know, the author gets asked to write this novel, this book from the elder's, you know, views on the world. And, you know, that's where the novel came out of, the real Kent Nerburn's experience. White Europeans typically have a very, very different experience in Lakota country than white Americans. In the Nerburn perspective, Kent Nerburn's reality, there's always a sort of shadow of history on the wall between the way he sees it, between white people and so that was a crucial thing to give me, you know, a handle on his character. And so for me, that's a huge part of it. It's the awkwardness of this, you know, white American in that space.
Can you tell me a little bit about Dave Bald Eagle's character?
You know, people are madly in love with his character the character Dan in the novel. And that's who he was in life. He was just somebody that was, you know, this magnetic human being and drew a huge number of people in. And so he's put his spirit on screen, and he had a closer, you know, for example, the film climaxes at Wounded Knee, and he had a closer link to the massacre of 1890 than even the character he was playing. I mean, Dave's people were the Minicosu of Cheyenne River that fled down there and were massacred down there. So I had him improvise the whole climax of the movie because he could go far deeper than any words we could ever put on the page. And at the end of a deeply powerful scene, he turns to the actor Christopher Sweeney, who's playing opposite, and said, "I've been holding that in for 95 years." And really, that's what he put on screen in this film. And, you know, the reason it's got an almost perfect audience score on Rotten Tomatoes, 4.7 out of 5 and 95%, isn't because it's, you know, some kind of magnificent piece of cinema. It's because the audience are being so deeply touched by him.
You just mentioned this, that you filmed part of the story at Wounded Knee. Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience was like, working with the actors on ground that was so, you know, that is sacred?
Before we started filming there, Dave conducted a ceremony just for us. And, you know, Richard Ray Whitman, who is, you know, the third lead, you know, he was there for pretty much 71 days during the Wounded Knee occupation of 1973, you know, where they were surrounded by government forces and, you know, hundreds of thousands of bullets being fired. So, you know, it was something that was very alive to all of them. But the most miraculous thing for me was that, you know, Dave Bald Eagle's performances went up two or three gears whenever we were filming there. He was drawing an energy from somewhere very mystical almost. I don't mean in terms of what was coming out of his mouth, because he was talking about the most practical and moving things, but just in terms of, you know, this old man who was getting stronger and stronger in front of our eyes. But the climactic scene that I was talking about a minute ago, we filmed that elsewhere in a very, very private location, because it was so personal for the actors. We just couldn't have had anyone, you know, within the vicinity.
So you said Dave Bald Eagle performed a ceremony for the cast and crew before the filming of this scene. Can you describe that?
Well, it was, you know, it was prayer and it was smudging, and so a cleansing for all of us. And it was just really focusing us. It's interesting how, you know, I could never imagine a more, you know, my entire career, an experience where I see somebody literally transferring their spirit onto the screen like, you know, he does in this film. He, just in every pore of his body, just has that quality of the people that were brought up by people born free, which is the sort of term that gets used. You know, I mean, Dave's grandfather was one of the prominent people at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and he knew him for many years because he lived to be a very, very old man.
So what about this movie do you think is resonating with audiences? It's obviously a pretty personal story, but why do you think audiences are walking away so impacted by it?
You know, I had a manager of a theater reach out to me and tell me, you've got to hear this story, she said. She, you know, she had this elder white gentleman in his 70s come up to her after a showing. And she said, this is the kind of man you'd imagine would never show emotions to anyone. But he could barely speak because he was sobbing so hard. The film had so deeply moved him. And it turned out it was his second time seeing it. Clearly, it was tapping into something he'd been sitting on inside of himself for a while to have that sort of flood of emotions. And I think it is that thing. It's allowing people to see their world in a different way. And I think that's Dave's gift. But the one thing about creating narrative characters is it allows people to open their hearts in a different way because the way you take a journey with these characters. And yet, because Dave was more Dan than Dan, we do both in tandem. So you are literally experiencing, you know, almost like reality and fiction at the same time, which is very unusual.
This movie will be showing in Aspen on Indigenous Peoples Day, and it's our first year as a city celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day. Why was it important to you to involve so many Indigenous cast and crew on this project?
Well, you know, I mean, in terms of the casting, I was very fortunate not just having, obviously an Indigenous cast, but actually a lot of the most established actors out there who understood the importance of the film. And so, you know, were very kind to take on roles far smaller than they were used to, but just because they believed in it. But, you know, for me, it's about, you know, I'm a storyteller. It's in my blood. Filmmaking is in my blood. But for me, it's being able to infuse that with bringing the audience into corners of the world or each other that we're not used to seeing, so that we can gain greater understanding through it, but not in a sanctimonious way, but in a very, very real way. And that's been my experience on the reservation. It's been through very, very deep friendships. You know, people often think, oh, is it, you know, is there some cultural fascination or whatever else? The majority of it now is just deep commitment to people that I've grown to love and become very close to. At the end of the day, when there's something that touches people, you know, they're prepared to, you know, fight to push it over the next hill and the next hill and share it with more people. And so, you know, that to me has been a beautiful part of it, how community can support a film like this as well.
You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. You can catch these conversations again online, aspenpublicradio.org. The Wild and Scenic Rivers Act ensures that some special rivers remain free-flowing, and it just celebrated its 50th birthday. The national advocacy group American Rivers also aims to protect rivers. When President Bob Urban was in the Roaring Fork Valley last month, he stopped by the studio to talk with environment reporter Elizabeth Stewart Severy about what 50 years of wild and scenic actually looks like, and about American Rivers' work to protect two local rivers from dams.
A big part of American Rivers' focus is protecting rivers from being dammed. Can you speak a little bit to how that mission connects to the Western U.S.?
Sure. We were founded in 1973 as an organization to do two things, to fight dams and to protect wild and scenic rivers, because the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act had just been adopted by Congress in 1968, and there was a perception that we needed a national conservation group to fight for those wild and scenic rivers. to forever protect them. But at that time, there was all kinds of proposals for dams all over the western United States, all over the country. And so American Rivers took on a lot of those fights. Fortunately, we've moved away from an era of dam building to where now we focus on, as a nation, on how can we manage our rivers better, more responsibly, to address all of the needs, whether it's the needs of communities for irrigation and water supply, or it's the needs to keep water in the river for fish and wildlife and for the recreation economy that they support. And it's great to be in the Roaring Fork Valley because we've done a lot of work here. In fact, most recently, we reached a very positive settlement agreement with the city of Aspen to forever protect Maroon and Castle Creeks from the threat of ever having a dam built on them. And Mayor Steve Skadron and the city of Aspen did a great job working with us on that.
So maybe if we look at Castle and Maroon Creeks as maybe like a little bit of a case study for the work that American Rivers does, what was the threat that American Rivers saw there?
Well, the threat was that the city of Aspen had water rights to develop in the future to provide for the water supply, future water needs of Aspen, that would have allowed the city to build a dam on dams on Castle and Maroon Creeks, which would have flooded the Maroon Bells wilderness. And that's just unacceptable. I mean, you've got the Maroon Bells, the most photographed place in Colorado. I don't have to tell people in Aspen how spectacular and special this place is. And the city was not intending to build a dam anytime soon, but it needed to maintain its water rights for the future. So when the city went into water court to perfect those rights, to keep them in effect, we opposed that. American Rivers opposed that along with other partners in the area. But we made it clear, I actually came out to Aspen and sat down with Mayor Skadron and said, you know, we're never going to agree to build a dam on those creeks, but we recognize your needs. I think we can figure something out to address the city's future needs and also protect Maroon and Castle Creeks forever. And that's exactly what happened. We were able to, working with the city, to identify alternative places where if someday an additional source of water supply is needed for the city of Aspen, you can flood a gravel pit to meet those needs. And the city agreed to that and agreed to relinquish its rights to build dams on Castle and Maroon Creeks. This was a win-win situation. It was a great day for Aspen, for those, for the people of Colorado, and really for the people of the nation, because the Maroon Bells is a pretty special place.
Now, we're coming up on this year is the 50th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. And here in Colorado, in those 50 years, we only have one river that's been designated wild and scenic. But we do have a lot of other rivers that are eligible, like the Crystal River here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm wondering, why is it so hard to get a river designated as wild and scenic?
Well, for a river to be designated as wild and scenic, it requires an act of Congress. And anybody that watches Congress knows that Congress moves slowly in doing just about anything. The key to getting a river protected as a wild and scenic river is that you have to have local support from the grassroots. That's absolutely essential. And so in Colorado, 76 miles of the Cashlapooda River were designated in 1986 as Colorado's only wild and scenic river. The main criteria is that it's undammed in the section that you want to protect.
Mm-hmm.
It can also be a river that has unique recreational characteristics, or it may have particular historic significance as well. And the idea of protecting a river as a wild and scenic river sometimes is controversial because people think, oh, it's going to shut down our water rights. That's not the case at all. The main benefit of protecting a river as a wild and scenic river is it says we're not going to build a dam on it in the future. And we're going to try to manage this river to protect its wild and scenic characteristics.
Right. So it's more about the long-term focus of a river.
It's the long-term focus, and it's also the local support. What people that live on and near a river and enjoy it for all kinds of different uses, what do they want to see? We just had a great success story in Montana. The nation's newest wild and scenic river was designated this summer in Montana. Congress passed a bill to protect East Rosebud Creek, which is ultimately a tributary of the Yellowstone River. Mm-hmm. And the reason it got protected was because 9 years ago, there was a proposal to build a dam on it. And the local ranchers and landowners did not want to see that dam flood their lands. And so working with American Rivers, we defeated that dam proposal. And then they said, well, how are we going to keep from having to fight this over and over when somebody else proposes a dam? And we said, if you get it protected as a wild and scenic river, it'll be protected forever. And so with that local support, they got bipartisan support from the entire Montana congressional delegation. And the bill was passed this summer, and President Trump signed it. It's the first wild and scenic river created in Montana in 42 years. It's the first one created in the nation during the Trump administration, and we hope that this is a sign of things to come.
I can't help but think about Aspen and the city of Aspen as you talk about that, where here, as the city of Aspen sort of worked through this process of reapplying to hold on to those conditional storage rights on Castle and Maroon Creeks, a lot of the questions from the community were about, well, if the city of Aspen doesn't have those rights, what happens to them, and what stops somebody else from coming in and trying to build a dam on Castle or Maroon Creeks? Are those creeks options at all for wild and scenic?
I think that they would be options for wild and scenic, but I think it's really a question for the citizens of Aspen if that's something that they're interested in seeing happen. And if they are, then American Rivers would be happy to work with them.
How is a river eligible for wild and scenic designation?
Well, a lot of these rivers flow through public lands, so through national forest lands or lands administered by the Bureau of Land Management. And those federal agencies have to do land management plans, and they have to revise them every 10 years. And when they do those plans and they do the revisions, one of the things they have to ask is, do we have any rivers that are eligible for wild and scenic river protection? And if they deem a river eligible for that protection, then that agency will manage that river as if it were protected until Congress can act. And that could be, you know, many, many years before Congress gets around to acting. So the first step, and something that we're doing a lot of with grassroots activists all over the West, is working on those plans to get rivers identified as being eligible for wild and scenic river protection so that they'll be managed that way going forward.
Okay. Thank you for being here, Bob.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
That was American Rivers President Bob Urban talking with Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio. This week, you heard from reporters Kristen Kay, Zoe Rome, and Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. You can podcast or stream this show online, aspenpublicradio.org. Airtime is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.